So we don't have a name for the ancestor, but a modern day animal that's similar to it is called Amphioxus or Lancelet. And the remarkable thing is that the ancestor, which lived in the Cambrian Oceans, underwent a dramatic genetic event where all of the DNA duplicated and then later all happened again. And somehow these duplications gave rise to a new species of animal, and that new species became the ancestor of all of us, all of the backboned animals, the fish, the birds, mammals, including humans.
And the animal, what does it look like?
Well, you would recognise it as a relative, actually. So it's like us in terms of having a neural tube, muscle blocks. It has structures called pharyngeal arches, where we have facial structures. And it has a postanal tail. But it, of course, it doesn't have all our fine features. It doesn't have a big brain. It has no bones. It's heartless. So that's how it differs from the vertebrate animals.
Okay, and so then this very primitive animal, it started doubling its chromosomes.
Yes, actually doubling of chromosomes is quite common in nature, particularly well known in plants, but it's only recently been realised that such event happened in our own ancestry. And the remarkable thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that the progeny survived, you know, despite this massive change in doubling of the DNA, and then it all happened again in a later generation. Somehow the babies survived and became our ancestor.
So I think you were saying that the animals that followed this primitive organism that used to live in the sea had 8 copies of each chromosome. Am I correct?
The original ancestor had a pair of each chromosome. Then that doubled, so they had 4, and then that doubled, so they had 8. But then, of course, during this process and afterwards, there were lots of losses of parts of chromosomes and individual genes. So in modern day humans, this has been incorporated so that we're back to 2, but we have copies scattered throughout the genome that are what was retained from that time.
It's really a remarkable story.
Well, the discovery was made, I guess, 2008, when the sequence of the modern-day Amphioxus that resembles the ancestor, its genome was compared with that of humans, and that was when it really became established. Before that, various lines of research had indicated that this was a possibility.
And now you think that these spare copies of genes that we've got are somehow implicated in cancer?
Well, yes. So what we discovered in my research group is that the extra copies, so having 2 or 3 or 4 of particular genes, what this has really done is it's given a real boost to the communication systems in our bodies. So what we've discovered is that these copies form little teams, families, and these families operate in networks inside our cells. And because of the way that they work in this sort of team way, what this means is that cells in our bodies are able to transmit lots of different messages from the hormones that control our cells. And they do this in a way, it's kind of like smartphones. You know, what's special about smartphones is that they can integrate multiple messages and make sense of them. And cells in our body are better at integrating multiple messages, even than the smartest of smartphones.
And that's because we've got the spare capacity, the duplication.
Yes, having extra copies means that you can pick and choose and make up different transmission routes for messages. But the cancer issue comes when, because of these sophisticated systems that were required to make the vertebrate animals, the downside of that is that when communication systems go wrong, because of the sophistication of these systems, that it can go wrong, that can give rise to cancer.
What is the purpose in the normal individual of having so many signalling pathways?
Well, cancer becomes reliant on signals that tell the cancer to grow and divide and proliferate. Now, these same pathways are required at certain points during our development. So for example, as an embryo, it's essential that these pathways that tell cells to grow and proliferate, they have to be switched on in a very controlled way in the right cells at the right time to allow the organism to grow and develop. But in the adult, for example, what happens is that the cancer cells becomes very dependent on these pathways, whereas the rest of the body only requires these pathways at certain times for regenerating various organs and so on.
But wound healing.
Yes, wound healing, for example. But, you know, so the cancers have a greater reliance on the signaling pathways that tell it to do that particular thing, whereas the rest of the body, you know, is operating and using different signaling pathways that are telling different cells in our bodies to do different things at different times.
And I think that you were implying or saying that 60% of cancers had one of these families implicated, where you have multiple copies.
Well, so we have fantastic new data sets of all the mutations in many cancers. And what we've done is simply count how many of these mutations land in these protein teams. And the answer is that it's far more than their fair share. So these protein teams are more often mutated in cancers than compared with other genes.
That's interesting in its own right, because we're told that mutations are random. So why would mutations land in these families of genes more than should be, based on pure chance?
Well, everybody, I guess, has a sense that cancer is caused by mutations. But what we have then gone on to deduce is that the mutations in these particular protein teams are not randomly distributed. So many people are looking for new genes that have got mutations that cause cancer. In contrast, what we've found is that certain members of certain teams are actually spared mutation in cancer. And we think that this is very important, because what we think that is telling us is that these genes have to be non-mutated to transmit messages that are important for the cancer. So it's quite a new way of thinking. It's quite challenging for us to rethink the concept that certain genes are mutated and that drives cancer, but other genes have to be not mutated to transmit the messages that the cancer requires.
So do you think in the long term this can have therapeutic implications?
Oh yes, absolutely, because now we have a whole new set of genes to look at. As well as the genes whose mutation drives the cancer, we now have to really get to grips with these genes whose lack of mutation is required for the cancer, and these should become the new cancer targets for investigation for future anti-cancer therapies.
But presumably these same genes will be used by other cells, ordinary cells, so you can't just knock them out just to kill the cancer. Wouldn't it harm the rest of the organism?
Well, you know, we have a lot of experiments to do to test that idea, but the conceptual hope might be that if you have, say, four members of a family, and we find that one particular member must be not mutated in a cancer, well, if you have a drug that would target that member, we would hope to, you know, get rid of the cancer. However, there are the three other members in the family that will be operating in other cells in the body. So the hope is that other cells in the body that wouldn't be so reliant on that one member would have the other members of the family to perform the function that family carries out. It's early days, but that's the hypothesis that we're working on.
It's a fascinating talk.
Well, the way I've described it is the sort of conceptual essence, but, you know, of course there's a lot of work to do, and for us it's just beginning a completely new path, and we have to now relate all the genetic changes in cancer to the way that messages are transmitted inside the cancer cells. So that's the next challenge for us experimentally. But it's fun, and I think it makes a lot of sense, you know, so it's really fun to have clicked onto something new that I think gives us a new approach.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.